Professor Brené Brown's research shows that vulnerability fosters good emotional and mental health. It is a sign of courage. We become more resilient and brave when we embrace who we truly are and what we are feeling. The Vulnerable Scientist Podcast is a space for scientists to tell their honest and authentic stories. I am your host, Sarah Nyakeri, who happens to be a scientist, informal science communicator, and I help scientists create personal websites. If you want to support this show, go to www.patreon.com/thevulnerablescientist. You can also follow this podcast on all social media platforms at TV Scientist Pod.
Yes. To make it easy, you can just say Adrien.
Adrien. Okay.
Yes. Because it's actually a French name. To get the pronunciation right, you have to turn around your tongue in R's and stuff. So I make it easier. I say it in an English, more English friendly way. Yes.
Oh,
so Adrien
okay.
is fine. Yes.
It's okay. So, we would like to know about yourself, maybe your background, where you were born, your family, a little bit of that.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, so I am a Cameroonian. I was born and raised in Cameroon. I was born to a family of five, so I'm the fourth of five children, but actually, I would say in typical African sense, I'm being conservative by saying five because those are the five children from my mother. And yes, I grew up with my mother, so with a single mom. Mm-hmm. And so those are the five people that I call brother and sister. But beyond that, there's a big family tree. Short story, my mom was married, then she got divorced, then she had kids in two other couple situations that gave her the five kids. So each of those relationships also gave other kids, so stepkids here and there. So yeah, it's a big family. But yeah, I limit it to five and I'm the fourth of those. So I have three sisters and a brother. I grew up in Yaoundé. I'll say Yaoundé from the age of five because we moved from somewhere else. And if I can put it in context, Cameroon is bilingual, so we speak both English and French. Yes, and it has 10 provinces, 8 are French dominant and 2 are English dominant. So I am sort of a mix because my father is from the French side. My mother is from the English side. I grew up in the French side, but studying in an English school.
Okay.
So that gave me advantages, but also challenges, coupling different influences culturally. You would know British and French, it's not always sync. But yeah, I grew up in Yaoundé and I studied there from primary right through high school. If I can just give some highlights that may inform a little bit about where I am now. So there's the language part, and then there's also the fact that my mom, she always tended to push me a little bit ahead of the curve. So, okay. Yeah, I was always made to skip a class at every educational stage. So in nursery, I skipped one class, primary. The only stage I didn't skip was in high school because I was majoring in sciences, and most of the practical work to succeed in the advanced levels, the GC advanced levels, which was our system of qualification into the university, is done in the final year. So then I had to complete the whole series. So that made it such that I got to university at the age of 16.
Wow.
Yeah. That was a blessing and a curse, because I always wanted to study, let me not say always, I was good at chemistry, I was good at science in general. But also from a very young age, I think from about 8 years old, I surrounded by poverty and also a single mom trying to fend for five kids, I took on entrepreneurship. So I started selling stuff. I sold peanuts, I sold biscuits, I sold ice creams and lollipops, whatever I could get my hands on, but only during the holidays. Yeah, so that when I was now in high school, I had a challenge of fitting myself, either going the business route or going the science route. My mom wanted me to become a medical doctor, but I got scared of medicine through another story that we can talk about in a separate session. But the point of it is I finally settled to study pharmacy, because I thought with pharmacy, you need your sciences, you need a strong chemistry, which I was good at, and it's also a business. So I thought I'll be more successful as a pharmacist. Unfortunately, by the time I graduated high school, there were no schools of pharmacy in Cameroon. That was in 2000. Nowadays, luckily, there are quite a few. So at 16, my mom, she was absolutely categorical. I cannot go abroad. I'm too young. The only places you could go really at that time was Nigeria, or like really far. And my mom said Nigeria, no, because she watched a lot of Nollywood movies and she was just too scared to send me at 16 to go live in Nigeria alone. So long and short of it, I went on to university and I studied biochemistry. The idea for me for biochemistry was that I was going to maybe after my first degree, get a scholarship and get into a school of pharmacy. So I would have at least built up maybe a few credits that I would be able to skip some more time in pharmacy school. However, when I finished my first degree, I had a GPA that put me in a second class upper division, not enough. Actually, your second class lower. Not enough for me to get a really good full scholarship. And still at that stage, my mom, who was my only financial support at the time, could not afford to sponsor me to go study abroad. And still no school of pharmacists. Oh, I think there was one, but it was really, really steep in terms of the fees and also the competition to get in. So I went on to study a master's degree back still in Cameroon. And then after my master's degree, I finally had a good enough GPA, almost a first class. And then I actually dropped out. I dropped out because I was tired of the academic journey and I decided I wanted to go into the workforce. So I started working as a pharmacist assistant. For a year, almost a year. But then I was frustrated because I found out that with a master's degree in a typically science, mainstream scientific course, you don't get any privileges or advantages as a pharmacist assistant. Like you just go and start from the ground level. And I was a bit frustrated by that. So I went back and I registered again for a PhD, applied for a scholarship. I got selected for the Organization for Women in Science for the Developing World for a fully funded PhD fellowship. At the time, I had secured a spot in China. So it's a South-South collaboration fellowship. So you must, as a student from the South, study within the South, so within a developing country. And I thought China as a developing country is almost as good as you can get. So I wanted to go to China, but then eventually the time when I got the fellowship award letter, the China school had already gone far into the year, and they asked me to either come in the next academic year or to change where I wanted to go pursue the fellowship. So I decided to come back to the continent, and I searched for a spot in South Africa. Finally got accepted at Stellenbosch University, which was actually a good thing because it's ranked among the top African universities, even up to date. Yeah, so I went there, studied for like 4 years, challenges along the way. And when I finished, I did a year postdoc there. Eventually, I left. I moved to Mozambique, lectured there for 2 years, and then came back to South Africa, did another postdoc for 2 years, after which I finally decided to really go for the dream of combining my skills and talents in entrepreneurship and business with science. Got a role as a sales professional at my current company, and that's why we are talking today. Yeah. It's a long story. I've tried to really streamline it.
Well, it's an interesting one.
Yeah.
Ah, so you started business at the age of 8. Wow.
Yes. So I'm sure that you've seen, I know in other parts of the world it is termed child labor.
But
I for no one second assumed that it was any labor, because I initiated it. I asked my mom. Actually, my mom was one of those people who, she guarded her kids like a hawk. So I stubbornly told her, I don't want to stay home during the holidays with my friends going out to sell. I want to join my friends. And she thought, okay, if you're going in a group and maybe it will teach you a thing or two, it's fine. And I actually started with my cousins who were there for holidays, and some of my siblings as well. But they all fell off. They all hated it. They all did so badly because it wasn't their thing. They didn't have the passion for it. I enjoyed it, and I grew up. I think I did that from the age of 8 right up to when I got into university. Every holiday, that's about 2-3 months of daily selling. And it's not just selling, it's selling and buying your own goods again. So you sell, you go to the market, you buy your own stock. So it's all those lessons and skills, all those interactions, really, I think, that I enjoyed so much, and I never really wanted to let go of it.
Oh, that is interesting. Here in Kenya, there's a tribe called Kikuyu. They have that spirit of entrepreneurship, business, mm-hmm. that like mm-hmm. they're known to be excellent in business. No, I see you can fit there, have some strengths. Oh, that's a good thing.
Yes. In my country, I also belong to a tribe like that. So we all, I think every country has a tribe like that. In my country, the tribe is Bamileke. But it's interesting because I never really grew up with my father. So it might really have something to do with the genes. I don't know. I didn't grow up with my father, but I was influenced by that trait. So, but I also don't think it's really it because my younger sister, for example, totally hated it. She's more an artist. So, yeah, I don't know how true it is, but you tend to see that most of the entrepreneurs in my country come from that specific tribe as well.
That's, oh, wow. And, okay, may I ask you something? You said you went to university at the age of 16 years.
Mm-hmm.
In your country, at what age do a person get an ID, a national identification card?
Okay, that's a very good question. I think now the age is 16, but at the time it was 18. So I did struggle a little bit. For 2 years trying to navigate that in-between space. I cannot remember exact instances, but I do remember struggling because I could not get an ID, a national ID for like 2 years, even though I was a university student.
Oh, but thank God it was not a problem. You proceeded.
I think I was allowed to use my birth certificate for most of the things, like registering for the national exams. I think I was allowed to use my national my birth certificate in place of the ID.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So you said at high school, You are not deciding if you should do business or med school. Your mom wanted you to be a doctor. When the interest, your interest in science, when did it begin? Like at high school or earlier than that? What motivated you to like science? No, here science are really hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what motivated you?
I think the first thing is that I tend to be very competitive. And from a very young age, I don't know if it's an influence from my mother, but I can hear her voice in my head even today. But I was always pushed to be the best. So if there's something I need to be, it's to be the best. Not like do good, it's just be number one. And I think even maybe it has changed that today even entrepreneurs are regarded now as the highlights of the day. But back in the day, the A students, the best students were the science students. If you don't make it in science, no one is really paying attention. So I forced myself basically to love science, to pay attention in science because I wanted to outcompete everyone else. But also eventually when I started understanding what I was really doing, and my mom, she was always sick. So my mom for the longest time always had malaria. And when she has malaria, even up to today, it's like the end of the world. So I grew up, and my mom is a very strong woman, very authoritative, she has a big presence. But then you imagine the flip side of when she's sick and she can't even like lift herself out of the bed. So it was very almost disturbing to see that effect of disease. So as that kind of reality started hitting me, I started paying more attention to how I can help. What can I do in the future? Mm-hmm. And so it's partly that and partly the fact that I also had this mom who always said, you will become a medical doctor. And I also was very competitive, and science was always for the smartest the brightest students had to excel in science. So it was hard work and also just being alert to the fact that in my environment, if you succeeded in science, then you were regarded as a success.
Oh, wow.
Is it different in Kenya? I mean, the dynamics of the different the different areas of study, which one is regarded as the best or the A-listers?
Pardon, which is?
So I know usually you have like four categories about there. You have the scientists, you have those who are excellent in sports and athleticism. Mm-hmm. You have those who are kind of business savvy, and then you have the artists. So those who are in the performing arts and stuff. So yeah, I'm asking in Kenya, who are those that are regarded in the society as role models?
Oh, the ones that are in science. No, like in university, those medics.
Yes.
They're telling us, oh my, if you are doing something to do with medicine or health sciences.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you are regarded as like this is the sharpest student, you know.
Yes.
Someone is doing business, like a joker or something like that.
Uh-huh.
Then you come to artists, but yeah, those are regarded as the lineage, not the, the people pursuing science.
Yeah.
And medicine, pharmacy, those people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's very much the same.
Yeah,
you have those that excel in sports and physical ability, but usually those are the people that you tend to say, they're not good at school. At least they can do sports.
Exactly. That's what you say.
Yeah, and in my case, I was like, I'm not good at sports. At least I'm good in school.
Oh, it's always left. When we find someone who is good at school and also at sport, it's so rare.
Yeah,
there are few. It has to be one.
Yeah, true.
Yeah, so, okay, now that is interesting. Like, you didn't have a nini. I can say that, like, your mom, she has malaria. I guess it motivated you more. To motivate you more, find at least find a disease, a cure, you know, how to help her. You said you got your first job after you are done with master's, right, as a pharmacist assistant.
Yes.
How did you get it? And as some, you can tell us more about other jobs that you have done.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So at the time when I finished my master's, I went to live with an aunt. I selected her specifically because she was a pharmacist, and I still had this passion to eventually deviate into pharmacy. And she told me, with a master's in biochemistry, you've gone far enough. You can get into pharmacy, but there are other ways to integrate the world of pharmaceuticals without necessarily having to go again for a 4-year or 5-year course to become a certified pharmacist. So she said you can become a pharmaceutical representative. That's basically a drug representative or medical, I don't know how it's called in Kenya, but where you represent the pharmaceutical companies and you go to doctors and pharmacists and kind of do some marketing to get them to stock on this particular brand and prescribe it. So I thought that was just perfect because it will bring the two things together for me, the selling and the science and the pharmacy. And it's around, I kind of always guided myself around drugs. So even for my master's thesis, I did a project around medicinal plants, just so that I'm always within the system, for medicinal, for drug development. So she, at the time, it was rare to get those job openings. Nowadays is a bit more open, as in the companies themselves launch or they announce vacancies and you can apply directly. But at the time, it was very rare. It was like a bit like word of mouth, and it's just like one or two that will open up in a year or something. So I had to just stay near her just in case something opened. I had a call. She had a brother-in-law who had just gotten in, so we're waiting for the next opening. While waiting, then she had a friend who was, so she was a pharmacist, but in the hospital. So she was a clinical pharmacist. But she had a friend who was a community pharmacist, and she had opened a community pharmacy. And she got me a spot there through her friend. So it was really a family, a friend speaking to a friend and then recommending that I joined the staff there and I started working there. So it wasn't very formal, actually. It was more of an informal arrangement just to get some exposure while waiting for my break into the pharmaceutical industry as a sales rep. So that was a bit frustrating, because when I started, you know, you have a master's degree and you're feeling like, okay, I need like a corner office and all the privileges. And again, it was an informal thing. It was a family-owned pharmacy. So in there, there were people that didn't really, they had not really gone to school so much. But they were family members, so they could get away with anything. And then you also had those who had barely had a degree. I think the senior person, they had not had a degree, but then he had been a pharmacist assistant for over a decade. So he knew his stuff. He could even prescribe in place of the pharmacist for a few things. But then I come in and I have to like clean the shelves and take stock and do all the menial things. And at that time, my ego was really, really high up there. So I couldn't take it. And then the other thing that really turned me off was that I had to work 7 days a week. So even on Sundays. Yeah. Even on Sundays. So it was very frustrating, because I was trying to also, one thing about me is that I always need to be on the path of self-development. I find that if I stop learning, if I stop trying to better myself and just get in a routine, it is very frustrating and I don't cope. So I had to always be working 7 days a week, sometimes even without breaks in the day. So I didn't see that I was going to grow in that role. I wasn't even expecting to grow in that role. And then the role I was hoping for wasn't coming. So I just decided one of those occasions that you get at work, staff disputes and stuff, I decided that was it and I dropped out. So I dropped out of it and then I went straight away and registered as a PhD student, because at least as a PhD student, I thought I'll have free internet, free internet access. At that time, internet was really expensive, by the way. It was just the advent of internet and personal computers and all that. So I went and registered as a PhD student, so I have access to free internet, and then I can apply for scholarships and, you know, take on courses. I remember during that time, I also studied for a GRE, because one of the things I wanted to do was maybe go immigrate to the US, where we knew that more opportunities for scholarships are available for PhD. And within that time, I was also working. The professor in whose lab I was working, he also hired me partly as a research assistant, so I could earn a bit of side pocket allowance while registered. So that was, I would think, my second job officially as a research assistant. And then eventually when I got selected for the OWSD fellowship and I moved to South Africa, it was focused on the studies, but then my scholarship was for 3 years. And then my professor at the time decided that I needed a fourth year to complete the story that we're trying to tell with my PhD. But then there was no funding available from my sponsors at the time. And so I had to now take on extra jobs. So in that fourth year, I worked, three or four jobs. I was a laboratory assistant. And then I was also an administrative assistant at the international office of the university. I also became a Zumba instructor, so a group exercise instructor at two of the local gyms, one of them the university gym, the other one was a Virgin Active. And then I was also co-supervising a graduate student, but on a salary. So I was being paid on a salary. And I think I also did something as a conference facilitator, interpreter, during that same year. So it was a hectic year. When I finished that, then I got a postdoc after my PhD. And after the postdoc, I went to Mozambique. And where I was living, they had just opened a faculty of medicine. And they were looking for a lecturer for biochemistry. So I had to quickly polish up on Portuguese. And I started lecturing there. I lectured there for 2 years, and then I realized that that wasn't something I wanted to do for a long time. So I went back to myself saying, yeah, the dream was to get into the pharmaceutical industry, and I don't think this will get me there. So I dropped that, and I took on a postdoctoral fellowship at a university, but it was a special postdoctoral fellowship because it was in a preclinical drug development institute under a university. So it was closer to the pharmaceutical world where I was going, and I thought that it was one step in the right direction. I got there, and for 2 years, I didn't do any research because there was no funding. Instead, I was working as a laboratory manager for the confocal microscopy, and then also sitting in as a reviewer in the scientific review committee. And I got fed up. I got fed up of it, and I just decided I'm not going to renew it. I am going to quit academia, and I'm just going to now start networking to get myself into, you know, business, the corporate world, because that's where I really feel that I fit. I like the tempo of it. I like that it's real world problems. It's applicable. I can see results and a lot of other things that I now understood about myself. And I really wanted to integrate that in my daily life. So that was in 2019. I took that decision end of 2018, January 2019. And then I took a few months to do networking and searching, and eventually got an interview for this job that I'm doing now. And yeah, they accepted to give me a shot at it. And as it turns out, today I just got promoted. I will become the person that will be spearheading Illumina. I don't know if you're familiar with Illumina, for the SADC region. So yeah.
Wow! Congratulations.
Thank you. Okay. So that has been my career journey. It's been a lot of knocking the head, but if you look at it from the start, there was a drive towards something. And eventually, I'm not in the pharmaceutical world, but I still feel that what I'm doing now is facilitating those who contribute directly into the pharmaceutical and even other industries. So I still find that satisfaction of being part of the problem solvers, you know, at the fundamental level. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. And now, what are your plans in your career now? What plans do you have? Your perspectives? Yeah, in your current.
Yeah.
In your current job, your career.
Yes. So I'll just tell you out there, I want to become the CEO of the number one ranking biotechnology company in Africa. I don't yet know which one it will be. Currently, it is Illumina, also challenged by Thermo Fisher, but those are multinationals. There are biotechnology startups coming up in Africa. So I want to be at the helm of getting, galvanizing the biotechnology revolution that is happening or has to happen in Africa. So if you ask me, that is my career aspiration. Mm-hmm. It is really just going up that corporate ladder and getting to a point where I can actually influence directly. My sort of vision and where I see that there's need in Africa and play my part in mobilizing the talent and the resources that we have in Africa, as well as the technologies that are being developed around the world and really focus on solving those problems that we have in Africa, be it food security, diseases, food quality, environment, sustainable agriculture, those things. So that's my goal, is to be part of that solution and really even at the head of it, if possible. Well, it's possible, and that's where I'm going.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, now in your career, what apart from frustrations and maybe not not attaining your goals, what other challenges have you faced? Mm-hmm. And what are the positives and the negatives that you have faced in your line of career?
Okay, and I think with the answer to this, you will probably get in. We'll probably get into another section that I saw highlighted nicely in the questions that were forwarded to me by Dennis. I think I struggled a lot to find my path because I didn't even know what was available to me. I didn't know. No one really sat me down and said, "So, what do you want to do? Why do you want to do it? And these are your options." I had to sort of figure it out, read about it. And there wasn't at the time a lot available, at least before the advent of internet being vulgar and ubiquitous. There wasn't a lot of information out there as to the kind of career that, or the career options that could accommodate my diversified interests. They were the typical, and I didn't see myself fitting the typical. So I was always kind of hitting my head and really experimenting even, and then going, no, this isn't for me. I don't feel like it. But the one advantage that it gave me is I have a broad experience in terms of different specialties within my industry. So within biotechnology, I've touched in on almost all the different niches, if you may, that gear towards the whole of biotechnology. If you're familiar with biotechnology, you know that it can apply in so many areas. And I've sort of gone through all of them in one aspect or the other. And so right now where I sit, as a sales professional, I have to interact with people in all of these areas. And there's no conversation where I go like, what are you talking about? Because I've had that experience. I've done a diploma in food science. I've done a degree in biochemistry and drug development. I've done a postdoc in bioprocessing, another one in pharmaceutical formulation. I've worked as a lab manager in microscopy and optics. And I've also done, when I mentioned one of the jobs that I was doing as a lab technician at the final year of my PhD, when I didn't have enough funds, was to work as a laboratory technician in a molecular biology lab. So I learned molecular biology that way in the beginning. So that has exposed me to all of the little niches that you have in biotechnology. And so I feel very comfortable talking to anyone in any particular specialty. It may take me a day or two to catch up to what has happened in the last year or two, but at least the fundamentals are there. Another thing is with my career taking me across different countries, I've had also that exposure to different cultures, different people. And so I'm also comfortable culturally to fit in with any group of people. The challenges, aside from the aspect of mentorship, obviously is also being a woman, you know, where the expectations coming from a typical African family, typical African society for a woman are different from that of a man. So I was very driven to pursue my dreams and my career dreams. Until I achieved those, I wasn't comfortable starting a family. But the expectations say otherwise. And I had to battle that along the way with myself. And eventually, when I was ready for it, I did get married. And then I had a child, and then with that also comes its own challenges. So every day you find a new challenge. Obviously, I'm not unique, but it's a typical combination. Like currently, I'll tell you, currently I am a foreigner, a woman, Black, living in South Africa, working in a white dominated company. Actually, I'm the only Black woman in the sales force of that company. My husband is Mozambican. He's living in Mozambique. So I'm singly living here with my daughter. He visits and I visit, but those are the challenges, the daily challenges of coping with all of that and then still having to show up at work and excel. So yeah, I think mentorship is definitely something that I think would have made a big, big, big difference. Still, I think I need to capitalize on. That is one of the things I would say is a highlight of my career, is that I didn't get enough guidance as I would have loved to.
Wow, okay. Being a woman in science and you have made it, it's great, like great.
Thank you.
In Kenya, you find few females, few ladies doing science courses because we believe they are hard. But mm-hmm. You have made it this far. My, that's amazing. And so my next question, you have said you never had a mentor. You had to find it yourself. But from the conversation, I have heard you somehow mentor people. I think you have mentioned that.
Yes.
It's a good thing. I am also learning from you. Yeah.
Thank you.
So currently,
I do actually, I'm very proactive about it. But it really started being, so I have guided graduate students as part of my job, if you may. But this year or last year, I actually made it a point of doing a mentorship program. So I started every Saturday. I meet up with a couple of ladies. Actually, currently there are three of them. There's one in Nigeria, one in Kenya, and then there's one here in South Africa. So we meet and we try to talk about our week and things that we would like advice on, and just encourage each other. So actively this last year, 2020, I started a mentorship program. And in 2019, before I actually left the university, I founded a company. We haven't really started our work because the three directors that formed the company at the time, at its foundation, just shortly after we formed the company, went in separate ways. There's one in Kenya and another one here in South Africa, but she got appointed in a directorship role, and then she couldn't make herself available for the work we were planning to do. So I founded a company that was actually going to do mentoring as a company corporate goal for Africans. It's quite ambitious. It's still registered. We still have a plan actually to revive it this year. Let's see how that goes. But yeah, I really think that mentorship is very important, and I really want to support mentorship in Africa for young women. That's a passion, a personal passion of mine.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Now, can we let's talk about are there opportunities in science for young students? It can be an encouragement, like my science courses, the opportunities, and something like that, the opportunities that are in science courses.
Okay, so and I think this is where Sarah and I began engaging, is that I personally was very frustrated also when, let's say, I was frustrated, but for a slightly different reason, is that I didn't think I fit the mode of finishing and getting a research or a researcher job or a lecturer job, and then eventually being into the what do you call tenureship for a professor or whatever. I did a PhD, but it was never for the goal of becoming a university professor or lecturer or something like that. I was always aimed at going for industry, or even if I had to do research professionally, I always thought I would be in a pharmaceutical industry. Also because I didn't really know what the other options were. So at least I knew pharmacy, at least I knew the drugs must be made somewhere by someone in a lab. I want to be there. But now with my exposure, I see that there's a lot that scientists can do. You just have to actually look internally. So the fact that you are a scientist, the fact that you studied right up to even master's or PhD or even a first degree in science doesn't mean that you have to become or you have to be on the bench, as we say colloquially. There's a lot of options that are out there. Currently, some of those roles are not even filled by scientists, and that is creating a whole lot of bottleneck challenges, because had it been scientists in those roles, it will be far more successful, or science will advance far better. So I'll just say some of them. Currently in my position, I see within my company, we have salespeople. So those who actually talk to scientists about what they need in their labs, and sell it to them. And then there's another position called application scientist. Those are the people that go to the scientists who have bought those products and assist them to set it up. They train them, they assist them with troubleshooting along their experiments. So they are not themselves in the labs, but they do understand the lab work. They know, they have hands-on experience, and they also kind of sit side by side with the actual researchers, scientists in their work, but they are more of a support. But they are part of the industry side of things. You also have engineers. Those are those who then look at the machines and automation systems. They will troubleshoot, they will assist with constructing programs, scripting, and things like that. So that is just within where I am. But now, if you go a step further, we represent suppliers. Our suppliers, most of them are from abroad. And within those companies now, those are the people who actually go from the product right up to, or from the idea right up to the product. And through that chain, you would have people in the labs that are actually designing and producing those products for the market. You will have those that have to sit in. Say you want to made a drug that has to go for, or let's take a good example, the vaccines that we have now for COVID. You need somebody who has enough law and regulatory intellect, but who also understands the science, so they can defend that product in front of institutes and regulatory bodies that need to say, okay, this can go forward or not. So those are now your regulatory advisors and things like that. So I'll just read you a list, and we can talk about anyone that you think is catchy. But I have in front of me a list of, let's say, 20 positions that typically within industry, someone with a PhD, and it doesn't have to be PhD, it can also be a very good master's degree, but typically with a PhD you can hold. And you have application scientists I've mentioned, quantitative analysts, science public policy advisor. So those who actually look into how they can inform policy with their scientific knowledge, product managers, clinical trials, project managers, competitive intelligence analysts. So these are now people, they don't sit in the labs, but they study competitive business and they gather intelligence in order to foster one brand over another. You have business development managers. These are people actually going to the field and seek new business and expansion for a company. You have intellectual property lawyers. You have research analysts in a venture capital firm. So sometimes before some people invest their money within these venture capital firms, they need someone that will actually go into the nitty-gritties of what they are investing in. And a scientist can definitely play a role in that. You have a market research analyst. You have technology transfer officers, management consulting, patent agent or scientific consultant. You also have what Sarah does, scientific or technical writer, research scientist in industry. We've spoken about that. You also have technology assessment and alliance managers, research project managers, technical sales specialist, which is what I'm doing. And then medical science liaison. Medical science liaison, those are people that take the information from the company and then they have to educate the salespeople with that information so that they empower them to be able to go into the field and sell the products. So they're sort of an intermediate between the companies and their sales force. And then finally, you have FDA regulatory affairs administrators. So those are those who actually have to compile all those regulatory documents and make sure that everything is in line for filing of approval or certification or something. They have all those things that they have to do. So I think in all of this, you can see that there's so much that you can do with your science degree. And really, it all comes down to your personal passion, your personal inclination, in addition to your science knowledge and training and skills. You can choose whether you prefer sales or you prefer more law inclined or more research, and then just fit in there. You may need to take on additional degrees and diplomas or certifications in addition to your science degree, but I think there's enough, and this is just a limited list. There's a lot options that are out there for scientists.
Sorry, that's interesting. Like, science field is very broad and there's a future for scientists.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's talk about mental health. What do you think? What is your take about mental health? And do you have some experiences of mental illness? What can you say about it? And the advices that you can give us, because mental illness is something that is affecting a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, by definition, if you have had your personal experience or from other people's experiences, mm-hmm. and what's your take on that? Yeah.
You would hear probably when I told you my story that there was a lot of mental challenges. I didn't call it a mental health issue at the time, but I'm sure that it was bothering to that. But also, I think it was more of a perspective thing. For me, I wasn't considering it as a clinical problem. I just thought it was just developmental pain. But yeah, especially when you're studying science in Africa and you have all these expectations and ambitions that get halted almost, either by lack of, in my case, there wasn't even a school of pharmacy when I really wanted to be a pharmacist. That can be very frustrating. Mm-hmm. or when you want to go somewhere and there's no money, you need to rely on funding. Or you even get there, you know, I got a postdoc and there was no funding. I had to spend 2 years and I got nowhere with my research project. I had no research output. That is very frustrating. So I think all the makings for mental health challenges are very much present if you are a scientist studying in Africa. That's just the plain truth. Because mm-hmm. even when you're studying, you can't really lift your head and see a bright future awaiting for you. You sort of have to dig really deep in order to find the motivation to go at it and to go at it in an excellent way. Many people fall off. I can't tell you the number of colleagues that left, you know, sciences and just thought, you know, there's no point. I'll go be, and I think Sarah wrote a really nice piece about such. I'll go be a banker or, you know, something else. This is not working. But for me, I don't know. I never really considered it as a clinical problem. So I never really resorted to, you know, looking at it as a disease and trying to find treatment. I just thought it's a question of finding your path, being persistent, reaching out and just keep working hard. But nevertheless, I'm very much aware of mental that in order to stay in this, in science in Africa, you need to take care of your mental health. So for me, luckily I found a very good outlet or a very good way of taking care of my mental health, and it's sort of become religious to me. That is my physical activity. So I'm very, very religious about physical exercise. I feel that I become more creative in my approach to finding my path. I gain courage, I gain self-confidence, and also just the feel-good disposition that you get from physical exercise. It helps you take on another day and another day and another day, and eventually you make it to where you're going, and that is that overall encourages you to keep pressing on. So for me, mental health, how I see it, how I deal with it is I prevent myself from getting into a state that requires, you know, medical intervention. And by so doing, I also think giving back, I found a lot of fulfillment through the mentorship endeavor that I undertook last year. So while we're going through a pandemic, I really found a lot of solace and a lot of, how can I say, just that notion that I was still contributing somehow makes me feel good. And then, I think if you are true to yourself, if you're true to your path, you work hard at it, and then you also give yourself a chance to release those tensions and frustrations through any means possible. For some people, it's religion. For me, it's exercise. And then also find a way to give back, to help someone else. Then you're not so much, you know, focused on yourself and your sorrows and your issues that you get into a depressive state. I'll also not underlook support that you can get from a spouse or friends along the way. That is also something that I think if you add into your arsenal, then you can overcome or at least cope with the challenges to mental health that abound just by the mere fact that you're in Africa studying science or trying to pursue a career in science.
Okay, so that is nice. So you're still the Zumba instructor?
No. So the thing about that is you need certification and it has to be renewed every year. And so I only did it for 1 year. And after that year, I moved to Mozambique. And in Mozambique, Zumba wasn't so popular at the time. So after returning to South Africa, actually I returned to South Africa while I was pregnant. So that also made it difficult. So no, I haven't, but I have somewhere in my mind, I really want to go back to being an instructor, because I also feel like it would be a great way to, I also have this passion for exercise that you must have heard me say that just now, that I also think I would like to somehow put it into my career somehow, somewhere. I don't yet know how. I've gotten the business and the science to merge. I want to see somewhere, maybe there will be a place to merge in group exercise instruction. Just because, like I highlighted earlier, I feel that you need a space for release. You need to take care of your body, even if it's not for the mental health. You need to take care of your body. You need to manage your energy in order to then face the challenges that we have in Africa. And even just as a way to get more creative and find solutions to the problems that are so unique to Africa. I feel that we as scientists, we need to develop our imagination, we need to develop our creativity. And I find for myself speaking that physical exercise gets me there faster. It gets me to that place of creative insight and courage to even act on those creative, what do you call this, nudges that you get. Because sometimes we do get those ideas and we're scared. We're scared to pursue it. We're scared to talk to someone, to start a conversation, to start a project. But I find with physical exercise, you get courage, you get self-confidence, you get more social even. And all those things build a really nice platform to start projects and pursue projects that bring solutions to problems that we have every day in our lives.
I have come to realize, like, exercise kind of therapy. You
know? Yes.
We used to see, like, exercise, it's not, like, tiresome, I don't know, it's boring.
Yeah.
But here in Kenya, I have realized during Corona period, people have really been enlightened about exercise. Even when you see TV programs, there is that Zumba yes. program.
Yes.
Yeah, so... when I interact with my friends, they usually say, oh, I exercise every day. At least nowadays, people are not exercising. I've realized that it's a therapy. Even when you have stress,
yes,
you just do exercise. And it's fun.
It is fun. So what you've said is so true. And for me personally, I'll tell you that with the pandemic, it's good. It's shown us, it's revealed a lot about us as humanity even. But one of the things is that we have been able to let go of a lot of misconceptions and excuses that we had previously of taking care of ourselves. We've now realized that we really need to take care of ourselves. The government will not take care of us. The scientists will not take care of us. We need to take care of us. And so for me, that is what physical exercise is me giving myself permission and actually giving myself time to take care of me so that I can then take care of others. I can then take care of my community, you know. So it's a source of empowerment and also just a source of managing your energy. That's, for me, is very important that I'm able to know when I'm in a low and in a high and how to self-calibrate so that I'm always productive, or at least when I have to be, I do show up.
Oh, wow. Thank you so much for the session. Now, I'll ask if there's anything else you'd love to tell us, to share with us, or anything I've not asked. You can, no, it's an open.
Okay. Yeah. The one thing I may want to share on or talk about is as a woman in science. Personally, I always found that, or I find that there is this pressure to relax, to sort of give up your own aspirations, your own passion, your own identity even, in order to kind of take shadow behind a man, behind your husband, your boyfriend, or your partner, for heterosexual couples, which is still our dominant, you know, sort of the recognized in most African countries, sexual orientation. But for me, I struggled a lot with that because I grew up with a single mom, and she taught me, well, from a very young age, I could see that you can be yourself. You can be by yourself. You can be yourself. And so I never really embraced that idea of, you know, at some point I have to give up myself, my name, my aspirations, my everything, just so that I could hide in the shadow of someone else doing their thing. And luckily, and anyway, when I was aspiring for a PhD and all of that stuff, there was always the popular conversation around saying, no, men don't want to get into relationships with women that are very educated, very advanced, or very ambitious. Let's put it that way. Ambition is such a bad word when it's associated with women, especially in Africa, you know. It's almost like if I want to insult you, I should tell you, you're so ambitious. You know, tone it down. Don't be too ambitious. And what I've come to find out is there's no such thing unless you give it permission. So I eventually got married at the age of 31. And my husband and I, he's been a bigger support, a bigger force for me to pursue my ambitions and my dreams. Even when I, for one second, thought, okay, let me chill. Let me just, you know, slow down a little bit, put my head under the ground and just, you know, be quote and unquote normal. But he's always encouraged me to go for the things that make me me and that give me satisfaction. And so I think women should not give up or settle just because they want to fit in the norm, in the mold. That's the reason why we see so few women at the top, because we kind of settle at some point. We start off being the best. If you look at your primary, secondary education, you see girls always like in the head at the top, but somewhere we kind of just go back to the end of the queue. And my mission, if I have any, is to show as a role model, but also to encourage girls to know that it's possible to have it all, not necessarily at the same time. Not necessarily to fit the stereotypical image of how your life will be, you know, but you can create your own life and still be you and still dream and still go for your ambitions. But just be open to the fact that you can make it your own and you don't have to give it up. You don't have to think that there's no support, there's no help, there's no man that will want you because you are too ambitious. Rather, while you're being ambitious, you know, look out for that man that wants you for that. Not in spite of that, but really for that reason. And they are out there. And then when you do get into, you know, a spousal relationship or in a relationship, at no point you should then become a shadow of that man. Still stand in your own light, still make your voice heard, still contribute to society as you, and even unite with that person to make bigger dreams and bigger goals. So yeah, that for me is something that I really want to impress on whatever or whichever woman I come across, especially younger girls, in that phase where you're beginning to think, should I now just settle? Is it worth going forward? Am I am I not sort of betraying womanhood by trying to go ahead with my sense or my career ambitions? Yeah.
Thank you. At least you have helped me. I was kind of disturbed. I don't know if it's disturbed or I didn't know what to do about that now, like giving up your career and giving in. But it's like it's not worth it giving up your ambitions and giving in to someone.
Yeah. No, there's no point. I mean, we can have a whole new conversation around that.
I love that.
But there's no point in doing that because marriage in itself is not promised. You know, it comes with its own challenges and you cannot then just settle because at the end of the day, you have to live with you. Even if you're lying in bed with someone, it's still your dreams. You will still sleep and see your dreams. You won't be dreaming their dreams. You'll be dreaming yours.
Yeah.
And it will haunt you if you gave it up, you know?
Thank you so much. I have learned a lot. I'm grateful. Maybe before we end our meeting, my fellows can say something, or say if they have a question, they can ask.
Okay.
Hey, okay, so this is Sarah. I've really enjoyed the interview. I've learned a lot from it, and you've shown like different aspects of being into science, like in terms of family, in terms of being a woman, in terms of the academic side of it. So there's something I would really like to know, especially as a young scientist, and I'm sure someone else would be curious about that. So you've been in academia before.
Yes.
And you've been to the other side where in the industry, right?
Mm-hmm.
So of course, you didn't. First of all, it wasn't like your thing. But I'm sure you've learned something that you'd really want to tell someone who wants to venture into academia, and what you can tell, how they can grow into the space, and also touch into someone who's interested, like someone like you is interested into growing into integrating business and science, and how what should they do so that they can grow into that space, so both into the academia space and both into the business side.
Okay, really nice, great questions, Sarah. So in academia, the key word, one that I particularly left because of, but I think that is the way to grow, is that you need to find focus. So in academia, it doesn't really encourage diversification. You need to find a niche. Even if it's one that seems crazy, actually the crazier the better. Find a unique niche, a unique focus of interest, a unique question that you have, and then dig around it in all sorts of ways. Be the thought leader in that particular niche. So, for example, if I can think, my last professor, her thing was she was in her PhD. No, actually, she was still doing a master's while working in industry, and she came across, she developed these nanoparticles out of oil, a specific group of oils, and they call them ferroids. And her entire career, academic career, right up to the point where she's partnering now with companies, be it in the agriculture space, in the pharmaceutical, the cosmetic space, is around ferroids. So if you talk about ferroids, if you even Google ferroids, I'm sure her name will be associated with it. But that is how she got her space she didn't let herself sway into the next fancy thing, the next flashy thing. You know, she found her thing that she was interested in, curious about, dug into it, found all the necessary applications, and then kind of partnered, which brings me to the next thing, is that you want to partner with people. And I think that is where a lot of scientists are lacking. We now find this one thing and we want to be the only one looking at it. We want to hide all the details about it from the next person. You're doing that, you wouldn't grow. You need to partner with other people, see how your thing can help someone else's thing and how the two can now make a bigger thing. But you are still your thing and they are still their thing, if that makes sense. So the thing is, with academia, if you want to grow in academia, is you need to find a point of focus and then you need to network with other scientists, drawing attention to your point of focus, but also being out there and sharing as much as possible about what you are doing so that you make yourself known, you make yourself seen, you make yourself noticed. And yeah, with that, it expands your opportunities, it attracts funding, and that's how you grow, because as an academic, you need funding, you need support, and you only get that support if you're showing up. And I notice with pity that a lot of scientists don't like to show up. We show up in our little meetings, maybe when we're students, graduate students, we're showing up just because we had to. But once we get that lecturer position, that first associate, whatever, we then just stay underground. And then we wonder why we don't get grants. We wonder why we don't get promoted. You stop showing up. People are not seeing what you're doing. It's not relevant. And so it's not attracting anything. And then when it comes to, if you want to go corporate, again, it's the same, but in a different way. You have to network. You have to talk to people if you want to know what the opportunities are. If you're interested in a particular career path, find out who is doing it. Talk to them. How did they get there? Find out, because obviously, like we mentioned, you may need some additional courses, additional skill sets to really prepare you and equip you to assume that role. Now, it's your job. After you've done your science degree, it's your job to take on those additional skills. And nowadays, there's a lot of free education available that you can take advantage of. And equip yourself, but also find real life examples or find real life projects where you can then apply those skills and use it as leverage to get yourself your foot in the door. What I'm saying is, say for example, a job requires you to have done some project management. It's not enough to just say you manage your master's degree, thesis project. You have to do more than that. You have to probably look for a real life NGO or something, a project, a developmental project or something, and then participate in that and then create that portfolio of performance that you can then show to someone and say, I may have a degree in a science, but I've equipped myself with this skill through this program and I've applied it in this project and these are the results that I got. That's, I think, for me is foundational. So for academic, you can make it popular by showing up and presenting as much as possible what you are busy doing in the lab. I think that is something that is still lacking. Scientists don't make public what they are doing. And then for someone trying to go the corporate or industry route, is that in your typical scientific training, you are not fully equipped for industrial or, for the industry. So what you need to do is you need to network with people who are already doing what you're interested in doing, and then seek introductions. Even if you don't know someone directly, seek through a second, third contact to reach out to that person. Find out what the opportunities are, find out what the skill sets that you need to complement your foundation with. Build on those skill sets, create a portfolio of you using those skill sets, which can be done free of charge around, even in social projects, even in internships, unpaid internships. And then once you have that portfolio, you've built yourself some leverage, then you would definitely get access. Or you could get lucky and just by interacting with people, someone may give you a chance, as was my case. But you need to talk to people. The business world, communication is the key. And if you're not communicating, if you're not talking to people, you never know the opportunities, you never know what it takes to get them. I don't know. I hope I answered your question.
Yes, you've answered it well. So maybe this will be my last question. You've mentioned about you wanted to go into pharmaceuticals, then you went into biotechnology where you do cells and you do it to scientists. So maybe for someone who doesn't understand what exactly you do, maybe you could expound on what you exactly do. And so that maybe add into the life, like what you normally do as a sales professional, for someone who would want to go into that.
Okay. So I'll give you a scenario, which hopefully the scientists that are your audience will relate to. You are in the lab and... you need, what is a common thing I got? I can even just say a test tube. You need a test tube that is produced, maybe they are local producers now, but let's just assume a test tube is produced in Germany, and you can't go to Germany to buy a test tube. And there are different types of test tubes. I know test tube is not the best example, but I'm just using it as a common recognizable item in the lab. And so you want to, someone from Germany will appoint someone else, I'm going to say in Kenya, to come talk to you about their test tube. Why is their test tube the best test tube or the right test tube for you to use? Maybe for some reason, there's a specific requirement for a specific type of test tube that you need to use in a particular test to get the standard results that you're after. And so this person needs to understand what you are doing in the lab in order to then make a recommendation of what is available so that you can make that decision to buy a test tube. Now, in my case, we don't only represent one company. I think when we're talking today, we have over 40 suppliers that we represent. And we have to talk to all the scientists around. So what we do is we understand what products are available out there for different workflows. I specialize in the genomics workflow. So from the time you're isolating DNA right up to if you're going to do next generation sequencing, all the products and even equipment that you would use through that workflow, I need to understand what they are, what they do, how they work. And I need to come talk to you as a scientist about what you are doing, what you are trying to achieve in order to make the recommendation of what you need. Sometimes you even want to take on a project, but you don't know exactly what you need to take on that project in a practical way. So I need to come and talk to you, understand your project, and then make a recommendation like, okay, you need this product for this reason. Maybe there are options in terms of price, in terms of how many samples you have. I will then orientate you towards those different options. So on the technical front, scientific front, that's what I do. But also I facilitate the sales process. So the sales process will involve me coming to discover what you are doing, taking it through now to where you have money, but it's not in your hands. It's probably sitting with your procurement officer. How do we get your procurement officer to release that money? What are all the paperwork trail that has to follow? Quotations, invoices, way bills, the logistics around delivering your stuff to you. And so, yeah, all of that is what we do. So we do a whole lot of admin. We do a whole lot of communication. We do a whole lot of training as well, technical, as well as just sales process training. And we are then like the face of the company abroad in South Africa, but also we are the face of the customer to the company when we are trying to relate to them what their products are doing or what is the need in the market that they can then orientate their production or innovation strategies towards. If that paints a picture, I hope it does.
Yeah, it does. It's like the med reps where they go in between the doctor and
your
company.
Yes.
Okay. Great. I think that's